We're going to talk more about this with someone who helps domestic workers leave abusive situations. Joining us now is Joy Sarumka. She's the executive director of the Break the Chain campaign. She also joined us here in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
This organization started in 1997. I understand you've been with it since 2000. And I think I'm probably like a lot of people, I had no idea that this kind of thing was going on in the United States. So if you talk to me about how the organization got started and why you got involved in it.
Right. Yes. Unfortunately, most people think that there is no human trafficking, there is no modern day slavery in the United States. But unfortunately, we're finding it's happening in our own backyards. And basically, that's how I got involved. I found out that actually a slave was living two doors down from me in suburban Maryland. And I was appalled that something like this was actually happening in this country. Basically, a young lady who had been introduced to me as the oldest sister in the family was really somebody who was tricked into coming to the U.S., told that she'd get to go to school, and instead, at age 13, came to this country, was put in the home, made to work around the clock, and of course, never saw the inside of a classroom. Of course,
how did you figure it out?
Well, I didn't, and that's in part, I think, why I do the work that I do. I wish I had had more tools. I wish I had seen the signs. For example, she looks nothing like the rest of the kids. And, you know, she was sad and despondent. We did see her every once in a while. She was always working, always cleaning, but again, just seemed maybe like an older sister. And that's how she was presented to us. So it wasn't until some other people recognized that she was in a bad situation. So that's how we found out about it. And because something was happening, you know, in close to the nation's capital, you know, in our own backyards, when I finished graduate school, I decided to come back and get more involved in the issue.
How does the organization work? What do you do?
Well, we do a variety of things. One of the main things that we started out doing was actually helping people out of these situations. Back in 2000, when there wasn't a federal law that helped people who were being trafficked, we'd get these harrowing calls where people said, look, I'm being held against my will. I can't leave. I don't have my passport. Sometimes they say I'm being physically abused or sexually abused. But most of the time, they were being psychologically coerced and staying as a maid or as a nanny. And what we started out doing is really helping them out of those situations.
What do you do? Do you physically go and get them? Do you call the police?
Yeah. At times, yes. There was a time when maybe the police and law enforcement just wasn't as interested in these cases. And so, unfortunately, we had to go out and do it ourselves. Luckily, law enforcement has come on board. They're very interested in these cases. And now they will escort us or escort other social service organizations to help somebody get out of the situation.
We've been talking about this case in Long Island where the two Indonesian women were kept captive. I don't know if there's any other way to describe it. At least they felt that they were captive. Do you have any sense of how common this is in the United States?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think this is more common than we think. I mean, just as at one time we didn't think incest, you know, we didn't think domestic violence really existed because it was happening behind closed doors. I think this is an issue that's happening behind closed doors, and unfortunately, we're not hearing about it. Every time there's an article in the newspaper, I think that represents, you know, one of maybe, you know, 20 or 100 cases that are actually happening on the ground.
But what basis do you have for saying that? I mean, sometimes there are just some bad people in the world, and it doesn't mean that they represent anything other than their own dysfunction, evil.
The basis for believing that is, unfortunately, that I'm overworked because we get so many cases in the door.
Like how many? In the course of a week, a month?
At some points, we are getting, you know, two or three cases a week. At other times, we're not getting many calls at all. A lot of it has to do with how much outreach we do. Every time I go and give a talk, there was a time where somebody was coming to me and saying, I know of a worker who's being exploited, or I know of a situation similar to that. Now, that doesn't happen as frequently, in part because there's more organizations working on this issue.
Many of the cases that have been in the news, these are grown women. And I think people have trouble understanding why they don't walk away.
Right.
And if they can call you, why does it get to the point where they don't leave before the case becomes so extreme that they're on the verge of starvation?
Many people ask the question as to why people don't leave. Then they don't have, you know, chains on their legs. The windows aren't locked. You know, I'm often called in as an expert witness to talk about the fear factors that keep somebody in that situation. And there are a variety of them. The first one usually is they don't speak English, right? So they're not quite sure where to turn to. They often aren't the people who call us. There usually has to be some sort of intermediary that they've talked to that then knows our number and call. So it's not sort of a harder direct line just to us.
What's the most memorable case that you've been involved in? I'm sure they all are memorable, but is there something that stands out that I think stands as an emblem of what you're trying to tell us about?
Yeah. One case that comes to mind involves a woman from West Africa who came to this country and was told that she was just going to take care of two children. When she got here, found out there was four, the woman had just had twins, and she was forced to sleep with those babies. So in essence, she was on call 24 hours a day. She soon was getting beaten by both the man and the woman of the house, and she attempted to run away. And she ran away in the winter, and when the cops found her, they returned her to the home, and they said, you know, you need to get this woman a coat. So her abusers bought her a coat. On another occasion, she attempted to call the cops, and when the cops came, she showed that she was being beaten by making gestures, and they said, well, she's crazy. We don't know what to do with her. The cops took her away to a mental institution. They tied her up, they drugged her, and she was unable to tell her story. Eventually, she was returned to her abuser once again.
How did she finally get out of that?
She finally got out of it because another cop heard of the beatings from a friend in the apartment building, got somebody who could actually translate for her and actually tell her story. And it came out that she had been abused this whole entire time. She was able to get out. And eventually she wanted to return home. She didn't even want to go through the justice system here in the United States because the beatings were so horrendous and her experience was so awful.
Are there many, you've often described scenarios where these are people coming from overseas to the United States and then bringing people, often third country nationals with them. Is that the typical scenario?
We are seeing that as one of the scenarios. But we're also seeing Americans actually being a part of this. And I think that's very important. We had one situation, for example, that involved a professor from an Ivy League school who actually brought over an individual from India, you know, slapped her around, didn't think much of it, and said, I'm paying her the way she would have been paid in India.
Was he of Indian background?
No, this is an everyday individual of Caucasian persuasion, a woman who worked at an Ivy League school who actually, unfortunately, taught women's studies and economic development. That's how frightening it is. So, you know, as much as we think that this might be something that's happening sort of outside, unfortunately, it's something that Americans are doing, foreign nationals are doing, and we're seeing it sort of across the board.
You talked about the fact that you lived in a community where it turned out that this was going on and you wished that you had been able to be more helpful. What would you recommend to someone who suspects that there is something wrong but doesn't know what to do, perhaps doesn't speak the language that the person in question speaks, but just sees something that doesn't feel right?
Trust your gut and make sure you're moving safely. I think it's very important that people don't put themselves into any sort of danger. But if you can, if you're able to find somebody who speaks that language and you're able to jot down some questions so that you can at least have either you or an interpreter ask those questions, and they could be simple questions. Something as simple as, how do you like your job? Or how do you like the United States? Sometimes those have broken open some of the biggest cases we've ever heard of. I often say I like a nosy neighbor. I like somebody who will ask, you know, one or two questions just to get a sense of where things are. If there's trust built, hopefully that person will feel comfortable telling you a little bit more. And if there is some sort of abusive situation, they may reach out to that individual.
And what would you say to someone who said, look, you know what, this is my neighbor. I really don't know for a fact that there's something going on. And, you know, I have a good relationship with this person. Their kids play with my kids.
Call us.
What do I do?
Yeah, no, I would say call us. You can anonymously report something. You can let us know. Give us as much information as possible, and we can move forward with it. I don't think people should feel that they have to publicly come forward themselves.
Joy Zaremka is the executive director of the Break the Chain campaign. She joined us here in the studio in Washington. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.